QST you will find, or any, I don't believe any of the magazines anymore will publish anything that has to do with gain figures of antennas, Dick. Go ahead.
Oh boy, you're right on this one. The worst case I know of is a popular antenna company that still exists made a particular kind of a log periodic cell Yagi antenna for 432. I think this thing had about 16 elements to it. They claimed 24 decibels of gain. 24.0. And because this lying was going on in the advertising department of so many antenna manufacturers, the East Coast VHF Society, headed up by, at that time, Dr. Alan Katz, KTUIH, of Moonbound, Spain, he started way back in 1968 antenna gain measurements at Trenton State College and also at Saddlebrook Park. So every year from 1968 on, for the next 20 or so years, all of the popular antennas by the manufacturers, as well as the homebrew antennas by ham radio operators from the surrounding five states, would get together in Saddlebrook Park, and Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, of Bell Laboratories, would set up the antenna range, and they measured the real gain of these 2-meter, 432, and 1296 antennas. When they measured that popular brand that still exists, 24 dB gain, log periodic cell, Yagi, it measured 11 and a fraction. Another antenna from that same manufacturer claimed 15 and a half, and it measured something like 7.8. So when these numbers got published, by published I mean now the members of the East Coast VHF Society would send it to anyone who showed up to the contest, anyone else who you know was a big name in VHF. They got a mailing by snail mail in 1970 of what were the gain measurements at that event. In some cases, the magazines were afraid to publish this stuff because that was their advertisers. So sometimes the evidence didn't get published, but it got inadvertently published. It got published by snail mail because all the VHF guys were laughing under their breath, getting on the air and discussing it. So, I mean, if somebody claimed 24 dB and you measured 23.3, that's measurement error. When they claim 24 and you measure 11, you know something is bad. When they claim 15.5 and you measure 7.8 or whatever it was, you know something is really bad. And you're about to ask how many of the manufacturers told the truth. The answer was almost none of them. And so these guys got together every darn year, and eventually Paul Wade, WA1ZZF, as his call letters were then, now he's W1
repeater, timeout,
he's now W1 gigahertz, W1 Golf Hotel Zulu. He used to be WA2ZZF, Paul Wade. And he's got his online book of antenna engineering, microwave antenna engineering. You Google those callers, W1 gigahertz, G8Z, and you'll find his online book. Some very good information. Not all of it's perfect. I challenge him on a couple of things, but 90-some-odd percent of it is not good information. And so when Alan Katz could no longer do it, Paul Wade took over and ran these antenna game competitions year after year. It went on for like 20-some-odd years. And boy, were they an eye-opening. So it's pretty strong evidence that almost none of the manufacturers came close to telling the truth. Because if they did, no one would buy it. Because all the other guys that were lying were coming up with great big numbers, and naive newbies were coming along saying, where do I get the biggest bang for the dollar? And they made the mistake of thinking the claim of gain was significant and traceable and verifiable. Far from it. Back to you, Mel. KQKUI, KQLIW.
Roger, roger. This is KQKUI. That's what it did. It became a contest of who could outdo the other one. Nothing to back it up. I believe there was, let's see, the EIA Electronics Industries Association had a method for measuring the gain of an amateur radio antenna. I think they once outlined something that came up, but how far that ever was pursued. In other words, the EIA method, was it ever pursued to the point that if now you do, contact a manufacturer of an antenna, is it traceable to those standards? I think if I remember correctly that it was laid out by the EIA, Dick. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on that, over.
Okay, there is the so-called EIA standard antenna for VHF testing. It is two dipoles in front of a ground plane. So the size of the ground plane is clearly defined. The distance of the dipoles in front of the ground plane is clearly defined. The separation between the dipoles is clearly defined. The length of the dipoles is clearly defined. The method of feeding them is clearly defined. It's a very manufacturable antenna for, let's say, 2 meters or 432. So the EIA standard antenna, you put it on the antenna range, you measure its apparent gain. You put your unknown antenna on the antenna range, and you compare the results. So that's part of the so-called EIA standard antenna. There is also, I'm not sure whether that EIA claimed it, but Dr. Tekturin, W2IMU, has an article in the antenna handbook. Yeah, in the antenna handbook. Hidden under the chapter, on the back of the chapter of transmission lines, of all places, he is outlining the procedure for setting up a reflective ground plane antenna range. Nobody on planet Earth, with one or two exceptions, has an anechoic chamber that works way down at the frequencies of HF antennas, 80 through 10 meters. The biggest antenna chamber I know of, the one that I worked on at the Edwards Air Force Base in Lancaster, California, the so-called Benningfield Anechoic Facility, 1.5 acres of ground plane space, 7 stories high, tempest-proof room antenna range, where you can put a whole B-1 bomber in there and make measurements. That's an antenna range. It becomes marginal in performance below 500 megacycles. Anechoic chambers for microwave frequencies, very doable. Below 1,000 megacycles, the world's best outdoor antenna range at the Rome Air Development Center in Newport, New York, and I've worked there for a couple of years, below 1,000 megacycles, they use the parking lot because it gives them better results. What I'm getting at is whenever you are measuring an HF antenna, you're always in a reflective environment. The ground is always reflecting. Even if you're in the middle of the biggest schoolyard and there's no trees or buildings or water towers or anything else around, you still have the reflection off the ground. Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, has this reflective ground plane antenna range testing procedure. I had a small subset of it, and I used that as a reference in my article in QSC, February 1976 QSC, on the ratiometry antenna range, a modification of that. So once you realize that every time you measure an HF antenna, you're measuring in a reflective environment. You can fight it if you want to. You can try to put one antenna on the Empire State Building and the other antenna on the Chrysler Building to get away from the ground. But you're still going to get reflections off the building. You can't fight it. Go with the flow. What Dr. Tekturin's got, and it's a much nicer explanation of what was originally in the Scientific Atlanta Handbook on Antenna Measurements, Hollis and Clayton, way back in the 1970s, the book was published, and it's self-published by Scientific Atlanta. And in those days, they made the world's best antenna test range positioners as L mounts for the antennas. Okay, so Turin made a nice, simple explanation of how you set up the correct altitude of the source antenna, the correct altitude of the antenna under test, and the right range length between the two. When you set those numbers just right, at your particular frequency, you are anticipating the ground reflection, using it in your favor, calibrating with it. So you can't stop ground reflection. You have to go with the flow. You can put down anechoic material, you can put down fences, you can put down valleys between the hills, you can do all kinds of things to lower the ground reflection. You can't eliminate it. It's a huge factor when it comes to the gain that you measure. You have to go with it. You read his article, you set up the parameters just right, and you will get an accurate gain measurement traceable to the Bureau in a reflective range. That's the way you can make the measurement if you care to. You can also model it on a computer. It's a pretty heroic effort to do it right. And is it something you've got to do? It's an interesting question. When it comes to confirming these antennas, that the manufacturers claim these great big numbers, yeah, you have to do it. And Dr. Tekturin was at many of those antenna test facility, antenna contests, as we call them, antenna gain contests is what we call them, of the East Coast VHF Society, starting in 1968. And Turin was there for at least 10 years, helping us out, laughing at the results, and explaining what all was going on. It was a fun procedure. And I contributed to quite a few of those, and won a few of those contests. That's where I cut my teeth on antenna engineering. And you could say to a small degree, I've been doing it ever since, and it's put a lot of bread on my table. K2KE1, K2LIW.
Tom Rogers, this is K2KE1. You know, it's a difficult situation. The average ham. I guess, what am I going to say? He can't do very much in this direction, especially with HF antennas. So, what you do, put the antenna up as best you possibly can, get on the air, enjoy it, have fun, and stop nitpicking all these different things. The three-element manufacturer, one beam, tri-band beam, the other one manufacturing the three-element tri-band beam, believe me, they don't nitpick that this one's going to claim a half a dB more or something that's going to make a big difference. It's not going to make any difference at all. And that's the bottom line. One may be, however, better constructed. That's possible. Sure, use better material. Things like stainless steel clamps. And maybe better quality aluminum, as Dick said. You know, those things, of course, can change the price. But don't think just because, you know, the price is going to be much higher that it's all in some kind of magic that it's going to produce some phenomenal difference in the signal. It will maybe stand up and last outside a heck of a lot longer because, like I say, of the quality of the material. But other than that, if you take out that factor, the cheaper one is most likely are not going to do any, not going to see any difference, believe me, between two, three element tri-band beams of equal size, spacing, and everything like that. You know, a number of them on the market. I know, the claims are ridiculous, but I think they've calmed down a lot. A lot of hands have become sort of, you know, clued into this game. All right, I guess that's it for tonight. I guess we're going to lose the repeater pretty soon. Back to you, Dick. Any final words? This is KKY.
Okay. You guys have just spent another, let's see, 2.5, or is it 3.5? 1, 2, yeah. You spent 3¾ hours of your life listening to this jazz. This was TechNet number 1149 of the series that began in September of 1982. We're coming up on September. It'll be our, I think it's the 25th anniversary. Yeah. The TechNet will be 25 years old this coming September, if I've got the mathematics right. 1982 to now, and I think I do. Mel and I will be back next week. Mel will be digging into his mailbag. He'll be answering some more of these antennas and feed line and transmission and propagation mode questions, because that's what ham radio is. We all have... built into every ham radio operator is a little bit of a scientist trying to get out, which wants to understand how in the world does that signal go through the air? Or how does it go through a vacuum? Not a single electron moves through that vacuum. When I'm listening to that signal from the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts, way back in 1971 on the surface of the moon. 10-watt transmitter, 8-foot diameter dish, aimed at the Earth from the moon, set up there on a tripod on the moon, and I'm listening to that signal down in Farmingdale, Long Island, at the Airborne Instruments Laboratory, Microwave Instruments Division, and not a single electron went through that vacuum of space, and yet I picked up that signal, and we call it a wave. It went through the ether. It got complicated. What really happened? I think Mel and I may not live long enough to find out what happened. We sort of understand it from experiential evidence. We see it happen. We know how to calculate it. But I don't know what it is. Is it a virus? It's a radio virus that goes through space. I can call that that. So we're all looking for some of these answers. We enjoy the quest. We've got the best antenna, the best feed line, the best transmitter, the best receiver, the best mode of modulation, the weakest signal detecting mode, the Joe Taylor technique, the best satellite, the best global positioning satellite receiver, the best television receiver with digital capability. It goes on and on. The best cell phone. And wireless is here to stay. The genie is out of the bottle. The public can't get enough of it. And if you want to know how wireless works and you want to be in that business, you are almost forced into hiring ham radio operators. They're the only people who know. You may get these guys with fancy doctorate degrees out of the fanciest schools who can spout all those equations for you. And they know how to solder. And they know how to tighten a 632 screw. Can they use a pair of pliers? Can they build an antenna?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And the answer in many cases is no. And you get a guy who's got nothing but a high school diploma, but he's got 20 years of ham radio experience. Can he build you an antenna? With the raw materials you got sitting in that laboratory, he can build you 5 of them in 2 days. And 3 of them will work like a charm. We're teaching each other this art and science. Maybe it's a black art. The schools do not teach it. We're teaching each other. You're listening to the process. At times it's a little boring. Yeah, we're tooting our horn. I'll admit that. I guarantee that some of the flack that comes into the email that Mel gets is saying that, what are these guys doing? Bragging about what they've done. Yeah, we think we got something to brag about. And as Mel has said, if you don't like it, you've got a bunch of knobs on that front of that rig. You can tune to some other frequency. You don't have to listen to this. But for those who do, we think we're teaching each other something. We think it's a learning process. We think we're profiting. Maybe we're wrong. If you got a better suggestion, make it. Enjoy. We'll be back next week. K2KEY. Go ahead, Mel.
Roger. Okay, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us. And again, we'll try to answer as many emails as possible. And I appreciate the ones, especially the ones that commend our efforts, and we do try to really give you the right story on everything that we bring up here. So whether or not you agree with us or disagree with us, I think that if you enjoy it, come on back for some more. Have a great week, everybody. Take care. It's going to be a little bit on the hot and humid side this week. Maybe some dangerous, weather as far as older people are concerned. So if you know of a neighbor or a relative that's on an age, we discussed it in the past that they have a tendency to be afraid to have the windows open and all because of burglary or, or whatever, and stay in a house and the temperature goes off the deep end. They can't afford the air conditioner or can't afford the runners because of the high cost of electric. So look in on them and make sure that they're, doing the right thing to take care of the situation that may develop this week with the weather conditions. 73 all, and thank you for joining us. This is A2KEY.
Bye-bye, you all. Think cool thoughts.